Thanks very much. So, thanks everybody. I'm going to start by thanking the organisers for what's been an absolutely fantastic week so far, and superb programme and superb organisation, so thank you. I'm going to continue the theme that was started this morning, and a lot of the things I'm going to talk about link with the things which Stephen and Angela told you about this morning. The main difference is that I'm going to be focusing on qudits rather than qubits, but Steve and Angela between them have already made a nice sort of introduction to this area, so I think I should be able to go over the introduction slides fairly quickly. So this was this is the snazzy title, but perhaps a more accurate title for what I'm going to talk about is contextuality and non-contextuality in qudit stabilizer quantum mechanics. So in a sense, the quantum computational, our interest in quantum computing motivates the study of stabilizer quantum mechanics, and Stephen did a very good job of articulating that this morning. So this is joint work with Nicolas Delfosse, Chihan O'Kay, Juan, who's going to speak after I do, Robert Rausendorf, and Lorenzo. So Lorenzo is here in the audience. And the two papers I'm going to talk about today were in particular really done under the energy of Nicolas and Lorenzo. So they were the driving force in these two particular papers. But it's part of an ongoing collaboration between us. OK, so the question that Steve very nicely introduced this morning was, does contextuality play a role in quantum computation? Is it a useful concept for us in understanding quantum computation, some of its properties, how it works, and potentially where quantum computational speedup comes from? And as a bit of a history, there was some older work which was sort of started by Janet Anders and myself, and in which Robert Rausendorf has also made some significant contributions, where we asked the question, is contextuality or is non-locality important in measurement-based quantum computing? And that was a very natural model to look at because, you know, if you're familiar with measurement-based quantum computing, what you have is you have a large multi-qubit entangled state, and your computation is implemented by the choice of measurement bases you use to measure the qubits one by one. And so that has a very sort of non-locality feel to it, right? I mean, if you, depending on how you interpret this thing, your computation has been set by your measurement on a bunch of qubits over here, and you're reading out the output from the qubits over here. This feels very non-local. It feels very much like a sort of non-locality in a Bell GHZ sense. And we showed that that is indeed the case. And you can make a one-to-one mapping between GHZ-type paradoxes and these all versus nothing proofs of contextuality and computations in this model. Now, I'm not going to talk further on this because I've got a lot of other things to talk about, but this really sort of motivated us to start getting interested in contextuality. And I should say it's really Robert who really pushed the angle of contextuality. I was far, far naiver, and I was just thinking about these things in the terms of Bell non-locality. So my talk today is really going to aim at the qudit version of the things that Stephen and Angela talked about. And we'll see that in odd dimensions, the things are very much simpler, and we can understand a lot more. And hopefully, I'm going to, in my talk, put together some ideas, you know, that have been floating around for some time and make some more concrete connections between them. Okay? So the motivation for all this, as Stephen said, was that in stabilizer quantum mechanics, in fault-tolerant quantum computing, we have this model where stabilizer quantum mechanics plays a very major role. And we've already seen this definition several times. This is a sub-theory of quantum mechanics where we just can consider measurements of Pauli operators, states which can be prepared by the measurement of commuting sets of Pauli operators, that's the stabilizer states, and the unitaries that map these states from one to another, that's the Clifford group. And in the perspective of computation, a very important result is the Gossmann-Knill theorem, which tells us that this sub-theory of quantum mechanics can be efficiently simulated on a classical computer. Okay, and then provide a explicit algorithm to do that, which can be very naturally generalized to from both qubits to qudits. So, you know, this would seem a priori a problem for fault-tolerant quantum computing, because often in fault-tolerant quantum computing, this is all we can do. But fortunately, there's a well-established way out of this, and this is to use state injection and magic state distillation. So I thought I'd show you the circuit for state injection. It's wonderfully simple. The idea is our qubit comes in here, our input qubit, to this map. It's going to end up over here. And by a combination of bringing in an ancillary qubit prepared in this state, which I've written U plus, applying a controlled NOT gate, measuring this qubit, and then applying a measurement-dependent correction, what we achieve is a map on this qubit equivalent to a unitary, plus, strictly speaking, some sort of swap taking it from this physical Hilbert space to this one over here. But it's basically computationally, this is equivalent to this. And the nice thing is, you see that we find there's a hierarchy of unitaries where we can start with just Clifford group operations here, and we can find a non-Clifford unitary U such that UXU dagger is in the Clifford group. And then if we can implement our Clifford group unitaries fault-tolerantly, all we need to do to realize universal quantum computing is to inject sufficient types of states to give us a universal gate set. But it just so happens, if we use this T state, which I haven't written down, but why don't I, for those of you who haven't seen it before. So this is nothing other than a, well, you can think of it as I won't write it down. It's nothing other than a square root of a square root of the Pauli Z operator. So that, together with the Clifford group, gives you a universal gate set. So now you've got the power of full universal quantum computing if you can just prepare this state T plus. And this is what it looks like on the Bloch sphere. So we have, this is a slice of the Bloch sphere on the equator. So here, these points here are the eigenstates of Pauli X and Pauli Y, our stabilizer states. And we can form a convex closure of these points. And this gives us a region of states which can be prepared as probabilistic mixtures of stabilizer states. And you see our magic state, we call this state T plus a magic state for the following reason. Not only does this state promote our Clifford group quantum computer to full computational universality, but also we can distill it from a noisy approximation of this state using Clifford group unitaries alone, Clifford group unitaries and Pauli measurements alone. And this was pointed out by Bravi and Kitaev, who found this combination of properties so remarkable they called it a magic state. And so what states can we distill is then a very practical question. So which states can we start with such that applying a sequence of Clifford group unitaries and Pauli measurements will allow us to create or distill a state which we can use for state injection? Okay, so this question was studied in Bravi and Kitaev's original paper, and then in particular Ben Reichard had a very nice analysis of this. And what he showed was that in this particular slice of the Bloch sphere, you can actually distill all of the states that lie outside of this stabilizer octahedron. So we're just seeing a square slice of the octahedron formed of the convex closure of the stabilizer states. And so this shows us that everything out here is, in a sense, a useful resource. It allows us to promote our quantum computer to full universality. And we know that anything inside here should not be able to promote our quantum computer, anything above that which could be simulated within the Gottesman-Knill theorem, because everything inside here can be prepared as a mixture of stabilizer states. So you see, in this particular plane of the Bloch sphere, there's a tight separation between distillable states and non-distillable states. Now, actually, that's a slightly misleading picture, because if we look at the whole octahedron, we do not get that very tight separation. And we split the states into three regions: states we know how to distill, states we know can't be distilled, and states for which we don't yet know whether they're distillable or not. But this gives you the idea of what a magic state is and why we're interested in its properties. Okay, so what is the key property of these states which makes them useful in this computational setting? So an early proposal was the negativity of Wigner functions. And we've heard a little bit about quasi-probability representations this morning from Stephen. The Wigner function is a particular form of a quasi-probability distribution. It has some very nice properties. It was introduced for continuous variables. So it's a representation on phase space. We associate every point in phase space a real value. It could be positive or negative, but its marginals always are positive, and indeed its marginals are always positive probability distributions. So you can interpret its marginals as a probability distribution which is going to predict the output statistics for a particular measurement. So, and it's a very old idea that the negativity of a Wigner function is a signature of non-classicality in some sense. Now, Wigner functions were generalized to the finite dimensional case by Wouters in 1987. And a particularly nice contribution was made by David Gross in 2006, who proved a very nice theorem, which was a generalization of a theorem from the continuous case called Hudson's theorem. And what he showed was that for the particular formulation of Wigner functions he considered, all stabilizer states in odd d, for odd d qudits, have a non-negative Wigner function. So if we have a pure state and it's a stabilizer state, it will necessarily have a non-negative Wigner function. But he also showed that those are the only pure states that have that property. So this was the first indication that there's a close connection between stabilizer states in odd d and non-negative Wigner functions. So, I see if you're going backwards. Ah, here we go. Okay. So at around the same time, this question of Wigner negativity as a resource was considered by Ernesto Galvão. And what he pointed out was that if you consider qubits and you try and construct an analog of what Gross had constructed for qudits, although I guess he did this before Gross, you find that you cannot positively represent all pure stabilizer states with a single Wigner function. But what he found out was if he chose two slightly differently defined Wigner functions, the stabilizer states get singled out as the states which are positive in both theories. So here he's managed to make a one-to-one mapping between non-negativity in both Wigner functions and being a stabilizer state. Okay? And this hints that perhaps the property of being outside this set of useless states might be associated with some sort of negativity of some form. And I expect we'll hear during this conference about the eight-state model. But in a sense, the eight-state model is quite related to this idea of using these two different types of Wigner functions together. So because I'm going to be mainly talking about qudits, let me introduce some of the formalism for qudit stabilizer quantum mechanics. This was introduced by Daniel Gottesman. So there's a natural generalization of the Pauli operators to a shift in our state space and a phase shift. You see that everything is defined using a dth root of unity, omega. And there's a very natural construction where we can represent tensor products of x and z using a vector whose elements are elements of the cyclic group ZD. And so we're going to be representing most of what we do in the cyclic group ZD, i.e. by addition modulo D. Now these operators have very similar properties to their qubit counterparts, but with a few very important differences. And here's the first difference. They have a slightly different commutation rule. So you can see that we can interchange the order of a tensor product of Z operators and the tensor product of X operators. And when we do, we pick up this phase, which is omega raised to the inner product of these vectors A and B. So it's a very nice, simple formula. And in some sense, the fundamental difference between the odd case and the even case is manifest in the extent to which we can describe all of this using this phase factor omega. When we work in even dimensions, we find we have to sometimes use omega, and sometimes we have to use the square root of omega. Complicates the description, and many of the properties I'm going to describe, or all of the properties in the later part of my talk, will no longer hold. Okay. So it really is only very subtle differences between the even and the odd d case in their definition lead to huge discrepancy in properties such as non-contextuality. So now we build up a phase space picture, and you see it's very natural because we can make a phase space out of ZDN cross ZDN. So that just means we're sort of building up this grid-like phase space using X and Z as our sort of fundamental points in phase space, our fundamental shifts in phase space. And for every point in phase space, we can define an operator where we just take a vector in ZDN cross ZDN, and we split it in two. The first half of it gives us a tensor product of Z operators raised to the power of the different elements of the vectors. I'm using this notation here. The second part of the vector gives us the X's. And we use this particular phase convention. This is a particularly nice phase convention to use because it gives us a very nice rule for composing these operators. So this is the rule for composing them. And you see it's very simple. Oh, sorry, no, this is the rule for commuting them, sorry. And there's a very similar rule for composing them, which I'll show you in a few slides. And you see that when we commute them, we get an omega phase factor now with this symplectic inner product. So in my notation, I'm using this angle bracket, this square bracket looking rather reminiscent of a commutator to represent the symplectic product. Okay? And for those of you like me whose mathematical education finished at about high school, symplectic product is reminiscent of the formula for the area of a parallelogram. So the important thing about this property is that when this symplectic product is zero, then TU and TV commute. So we have a nice simple rule. We take our vectors, we find the symplectic product. The corresponding operators commute if and only if the symplectic product is zero. So in some sense, this symplectic product is encoding the commutation relation between the operators very nicely. And as mentioned already, we can generalize all the ideas of stabilizer quantum mechanics. We can work out a Clifford group for this model. This was also carried out by Daniel Gottesman. And many of the same things go through. We've got a Gossamer-Knill theorem, et cetera. And we can also do fault-tolerant quantum computing. So what's the big difference? Well, for this audience, the most fundamental difference is while even-dimensional stabilizer quantum mechanics has contextual signatures such as the Peres-Mohmann square and GHZ contextuality, odd-D qubit stabilizer quantum mechanics is non-contextual. And that arises because of David Gross's Hudson's theorem. We know we can describe stabilizer quantum mechanics using Wigner functions, and has already argued this morning by Stephen, that gives us a non-contextual hidden variable model for the theory. So stabilizer quantum mechanics in odd D is non-contextual. So that's extremely useful because that now enables us to get a better handle on the connection between the properties needed for states in magic state distillation and Wigner negativity, and we can then connect Wigner negativity to contextuality. So, you know, we can ask the same questions, and an answer to this question was provided in this nice paper by Victor Veitch, who was previously here, working with Joe Emerson's group and also David Gross. And what they discovered was really the key property about whether a state could be distilled for magic state distillation or not is not to do with whether that state is a mixture of stabilizer states. Instead, it's whether or not that state has a non-negative Wigner function representation. And what they proved was that if you start with a non-negative Wigner function, as you evolve that state using Clifford unitaries and Pauli measurements, you're never going to introduce negativity. And because all the states we wish to distill have negative Wigner functions, that means it's impossible to distill those states from these states here. So they call these states bound states for state distillation, and they show that there's a direct link between the property of distillability for states and the negativity of the Wigner function. So I'm going to talk a lot about these gross Wigner functions, so let me go through the formalism. We assign a Hermitian operator to each point in phase space, and the expectation values of those Hermitian operators form our Wigner function elements. So what do these operators look like? Well, in David Gross's formulation, they have a particular simple form. We just add together our Heisenberg-Weyl operators, our TU operators, we just add them together, and that gives us a sort of central phase space operator A0. And then we use these Heisenberg-Weyl operators, which act as translations in phase space, to translate this operator around to give us all the other phase point operators. So it's a very simple definition. And so what's the link to contextuality? So there's been many hints over the years that negativity and contextuality should be linked. Here's a very nice hint from a paper from Rob back in 2008. Now, what Rob was looking at here were quasi-reps in general and a more generalized notion of non-contextuality. In my talk, I'm going to stick with more traditional notions of contextuality, so the Koch and Specker form of contextuality. And as we've heard about in several of the talks, one nice way of witnessing Koch and Specker contextuality is using one of these Cabello-Severini-Winter graphs. So these graphs give you experiments you can do, which you can use to detect, if you like, contextuality. And what Mark Howard showed with Joel Warman and Victor and Joseph was that if they looked at this magic state problem for odd prime dimensional qubits, they could show that whenever they had a state with a negative Wigner function, it violated one of these witnesses. So there's a direct link between the negativity of the Wigner function and contextuality in this CSW formalism. Okay, so that's my introduction. Now I'm going to move to talk about the results I want to give you an overview of today. I'm going to talk briefly about two papers, sort of give you a highlight of the main ideas in both of them. So first, a paper which provides an alternative proof of this result and generalizes it. And this is work with which was led by Nicolas Delfosse. And this tells you that for odd D stabilizer quantum mechanics, when we have a non-negative Wigner function, we can represent the state with a non-contextual hidden variable model and vice versa in a universe where the only measurements we make are Pauli measurements, okay? And that corresponds to the universe you live in when you're doing fault-tolerant quantum computing with the Clifford group as your fault-tolerant set. I'll then talk about a paper by Lorenzo, who shows that this non-contextual hidden variable model for Q-dit stabilizer quantum mechanics is nothing other than a model that had already been introduced by Rob, Speckens toy theory generalized to odd qubits. And we'll show how we managed to finish the formal description of that theory and generalize it to all dimensions and show how this all connects up. Okay, and so this is the structure of the argument. So first I'm going to focus on the paper with Nicola on the equivalence of negativity and contextuality for these states. And there's basically one key trick that we use. We start off with a nice simple model of a non-contextual model using value assignments. And then we just prove a nice group theoretic property of these value assignments. And that basically allows us then to calculate directly the Wigner functions for any state we represent in this model, and we can show that it's non-negative. So it's a really simple argument, and we're very pleased at its simplicity. So what's the non-contextual model we're going to use? We call it a non-contextual value assignment. I was concerned that what we were doing may be a little bit unorthodox in the world of non-contextual models. It turns out it's not unorthodox at all. In fact, Cochin and Specker consider very similar types of models in their 1960s papers. And thank you to Andrew Simmons for pointing this out to me earlier today. So this is our model. It's a model of value assignments, which means for every measurement we make, we're going to assume that our model has a recipe for telling us the measurement outcome dependent on what the actual ontic state of the system is. So we need a set of ontic states. We're going to call that S. We need labels for our measurement outcomes. We're going to use these eigenvalues, these powers of omega, as those labels. And we need a map from the ontic state to the measurement outcome. And it's non-contextual in the sense that it only depends on the observable that you're measuring. So here's two examples. So what are these maps? So they're just assignments of values to each ontic state for each measurement you can make. Right? So it's a little bit cumbersome notation, just to point out that we've got this. So the suffix here, the nu here, that represents the ontic state. And the u, written as sort of a functional input, that is the measurement you're going to make. Okay? So here's some examples of those maps. Okay, this is just two particular maps that I've picked out of the air. We could assign any power of omega or omega prime to any ontic state. And I should emphasize that I'm not, although my example has it, I'm not assuming that we're working with phase space. At the moment, we don't assume any structure to our ontic states, just that the model works. What do I mean by the model works? Well, we demand these further two conditions. One is that for our given state rho, the model reproduces the quantum statistics, meaning we have a probability distribution Q of rho given nu, which is our probability distribution over those ontic states, so that when we make measurements, the measurement statistics match those of quantum mechanics. And we impose a consistency requirement because we know in this world where we make Pauli measurements, there are relations between commuting observables. And in particular, if we measure the observable represented by u plus v, where u and v commute, we know that the outcome of those measurements is going to be the product of the outcome we would get from measuring u and then measuring v. Okay, so that's a property of quantum mechanics we're using in our definition. It's a property of Pauli operators we're using in our definition. So these are the only assumptions we make in our model, but this one in particular is reproducing a property of Pauli observables. Yeah.
So it's a property of these Pauli observables where it's in particular has to do with the fact that they have these roots of unity as their spectrum, which is a bit sort of non-standard for observables, which you normally take to be Hermitian.
So the fact we're using non-Hermitian observables, that's just convenience. That doesn't really have. So it's convenient. So that all that does is it sort of hardwires ZD into the description.
I'm happy with it to be a convenience. I guess then it just made me confused when you come to this important consistency condition, because that seems to really rely on that.
The only difference would be if we used elements of ZD directly, we would just say that. So this is basically saying that, well, if we were representing our outcomes with numbers that we would compose modulo d, we would say that the sum of the operators over here gives you the outcomes would be the sum modulo d. So this is just a convenience, but this is reflecting the properties that the measurements, the Pauli measurements have. I mean, another way of looking at it is these observables are built out of the same projectors. And if we are to assign truth values to the projectors.
Is there a way you could make this consistency condition a statement about projectors?
Yes.
It doesn't depend on the choice of eigenvalues. We get the idea that in observables, the choice of the eigenvalues is somewhat irrelevant.
So
projectors are not.
We can do that, and we do go through that argument in the paper. But I won't go through that here, but we show that in the paper. So let me move on. So the nice thing about this model is it's so simple, you can use it to prove things simply. So Let's start with an example. The non-negative Wigner function gives us a model which satisfies those axioms, and we can just check them, okay? So what would be the ontic space? The ontic space would be the phase space, and our non-negative values on phase space, they're going to represent our probabilities. And so there are probabilities, and also there are maps. If we just look at the formula for reproducing the statistics from the Wigner function, you see this formula looks the same as our formula in the non-contextual model. And the only difference is that the Wigner function, this phase factor here with the symplectic inner product, that now represents our value assignment. So our value assignment is represented by this symplectic inner product. And now we need to check the consistency condition, and sure enough, due to the properties of omega raised to a symplectic product, we can check that this holds. Okay, so everything's good. So the motivating sort of observation which leads to our main result is that, well, we haven't proved this. We didn't prove that this held for commuting observables. This property holds for all observables, all phase points, even those that anti-commute. And you can check that that's true of the Wigner function. Okay, the relation between the ontic states and the measurement outcomes is fixed with this property, regardless of whether the measurements commute or not. So it turns out that this particular structure has a name in group theory. It's an example of a character. Now, characters are not something that I've used particularly much in my research. We don't tend to use representation theory because we're representing everything with matrices anyway. But to remind you, a character is just a one-dimensional group representation. It rises by taking traces of irreducible representations. And it has basically two key properties that we're going to use. One of them is it's a group homomorphism, so it's reflecting the group composition in its multiplication rule. And we have this orthogonality of characters, which means that, in particular, when we sum over all the characters for over the whole group, we will either get zero or we'll get the order of the group. And that's basically like the rule of summing together complex numbers that are equally spaced around zero, or summing together a complex number that always sits as equal to one. Okay, so it's a very simple property. So these are the only properties we're going to use. So we did not assume that our non-contextual value assignment model has this property. Why would we? It's not given to us by the properties of Pauli operators. But we can now derive it. It follows from the assumptions in our model. Okay? So this is our lemma. If we set up this model for n greater or equal than 2 qudits, and we'll see we need that later on, and work with odd d, we can show that all value assignments in this model are indeed characters, meaning they satisfy this rule for all u and v. And this is the outline of the proof, but the key idea is that we can make a relation between, so we can use, going back, this property, we can use this property to interrelate all triples of commuting observables. So, and that's what you do normally in a Perry's Moment Square. We take a triple of commuting observables and we know there has to be a relationship between the measurement outcomes. And what we can do is we can form, so the way the proof works is, given any two non-commuting observables, you can find a path between them via triples of commuting observables such that the value assignments all have to be correlated. Okay, so this is the proof technique we use in the paper, but let me illustrate it with some actual operators. So this is a graph which shows how the value assignment for non-commuting x and z have to be related to the operator xz, which doesn't commute. So none of these things commute. But nevertheless, we show the value assignments are all interrelated. And that's because we can take xz and itself and their product, and we can form this triple here. Then xz squared can be decomposed into these two operators. So xz tends to zx and xz tends to z dagger x dagger. So we've turned the identity into two operators that are inverse with respect to each other. And then we can break this down into these two commuting operators, and this one into these two commuting operators, and these trivially can be broken into these two commuting operators. And the key to the proof is that you can do this for any arbitrary two Pauli operators in the Q-dit Pauli group as long as n is greater than or equal to 2. You see, we needed this extra qubit to get this to work. So that's very useful, but what are we going to use it for? Well, we saw that characters were important in Wigner functions. So what we can show, and we've seen indeed that every non-negative Wigner function gives you a non-contextual value assignment. So now we show that whenever we have a non-contextual value assignment for Pauli measurements, we get a non-negative Wigner function. And the proof is super simple. We just calculate the Wigner function. So we take the definition of the Wigner function. You see here we have this statistics trace TV rho. We have a formula for that, those statistics in our model. We substitute it in. We manipulate it a little bit. And in this middle, we get a sum over characters. Okay? And in particular, we're using the fact that lambda nu is a character and omega raised to a symplectic product is also a character. And if you multiply the elements of characters together, you get another character. So that means this number is either 0 or the order of the group. It's a non-negative number. Everything else in that expression is non-negative. Therefore, the Wigner function is non-negative. So that means we can generalize the argument of Mark Howard and co. to all odd dimensions. So their proof was only valid in the prime case. And it gives us a very different perspective. We did not need to construct a particular graph witness for this contextuality. We've shown it explicitly by constructing a hidden variable model. Well, we didn't quite construct a hidden variable model. We had this simplified non-contextual value assignment. So now I want to extend this into a full-blown hidden variable model. And this is where Speckan's model is going to come in. So the first observation from our calculation, when we show the equivalence with Wigner functions, it follows from this, and you can manipulate this a little bit further to find that the ontic space S, on which we assumed no structure, has to be in one-to-one correspondence with phase space. Okay? So without loss of generality up to relabeling, you could just, in our model, you can always adopt the phase space. Okay? So we've derived that, and that's come directly from this proof. So what does this phase space model look like? Okay, well now I'm going to switch to the second paper that I want to talk about. And this is looking at Speckan's model, okay, for odd D. So what have we had so far? So this is what we know so far. We've got our ontic state space, which is the phase space, and we know our value assignment map satisfies this character property. And if you want to develop this simple model into a full theory, we need to add dynamics and add a rule for measurement updates, et cetera, et cetera. So there's a problem with this, that we are assigning definite values to all of our observables, given the ontic states. And of course, that's something which is incompatible with how quantum mechanics works. We know if we successively measure two incompatible observables, we get a randomized outcome of the second measurement. So that would be in contradiction with this. But what can we add to the model to make this work? We can add an epistemic restriction. So we take Rob's inspiration and we add a restriction on what we're allowed to know about the states, and which you can interpret as a restriction on what probability distributions you're allowing yourself in your model. So this was his first paper in 2004. And this focused on the qubit case, and he introduced it as a toy theory, because as we've seen, qubit stabilizer quantum mechanics is contextual. So this is not claiming to represent qubit stabilizer quantum mechanics. Instead, it's a toy theory, which is a non-contextual hidden variable model, which reproduces many of the properties you discover in qubit stabilizer quantum mechanics. But then he generalizes this, and this is a paper from quite recently, where he generalizes it to continuous variables, but also to qubits. Okay, so can we just use his results? Well, not quite, and I'll tell you why in a second. Just to introduce the model, it's a very similar framework from what we've been working in. We work with an ontic space, which is phase space. We define our observables as linear functionals here. Now, what does it mean that it's a linear functional? It means we could represent our measurement rule as an inner product. But what does it also mean? If you look carefully, that means that this rule satisfies our character rule. The composition is built into the composition rule is built into are measurement outcomes for all of these observables. And that's sort of implicitly there by the fact that we're building up all of our observables from X measurements and Z measurements. So all the other, in Rob's model, all other measurements are linear combinations of measuring X and Z. Okay, so of course they're interdependent. So, and then we introduce this epistemic restriction that we can only jointly know two observables when they commute. So we can only prepare states which have definite values for sets of commuting observables. So did Rob leave us anything to do? Well, he did, fortunately. So in his paper, Rob shows that for odd prime qubits, his model is equivalent to stabilizer quantum mechanics. Or it forms an equivalent, makes equivalent predictions. But he doesn't quite, because he doesn't include the measurement update rule. Now, for someone like me who uses stabilizer quantum mechanics in quantum computing theory, the measurement update rule is basically the main thing we use. I mean, we're always thinking about measuring Pauli operators all the time. I mean, that's what, when we use it in quantum error correction, we use it in quantum computing. So the measurement update rule, in some sense, is the most important part of the theory. But Rob didn't work it out. But that gave us something very interesting to think about. And actually, it was in thinking about the measurement update rule, it gave us the clue, or it gave Lorenzo the clue, of how to then generalize this construction from odd prime to all, sorry, from odd prime to all odd dimensions. So this is what we did. We derived a measurement update rule and used that to extend the analysis to general odd, so actually I should say to all dimensions. The distinction we will make is that this model in even dimensions does not correspond to quantum stabilizer quantum mechanics, and this model in odd dimensions does correspond to stabilizer quantum mechanics. So to show you a picture of some of these states that arise, so these epistemic states, these are the probability distributions over the ontic states that we use to describe states we can prepare in the laboratory. And you can see we can measure observable X and get outcome zero, and what these plots represent, what the colors represent, is a uniform probability distribution over those ontic states. So every box that's colored white has probability zero. Every box that's colored one has probability uniformly dispersed. So it's one divided by the number of colored boxes. So this is an example of how the states look in this picture. And there's a formalism that one can build up. So I'll just give you a little flavor of that formalism. It turns out that these colored in regions always form a shifted subspace. So we take, in particular, it's a subspace which we call an isotropic subspace. So an isotropic subspace is a subspace generated by our set of commuting observables. And it turns out that all of the epistemic states can be written like this. So we take essentially the dual to V, which is the set of all points which operationally speaking, are the set of all points which, when we measure, will return the outcome zero. So they're all the ontic states where, for all the measurements in V, the outcome zero is returned. Now, we want to, this V perp would be the ontic state that corresponds to the case where all of the measurements we made, all of the outcomes were zero. To get all the other states, all we need to do is a linear shift. And this follows directly from the linear construction of the measurement rule. So to derive a measurement update rule, we need to know how to update V and how to update W. Okay, so, W. So what's the interpretation of this shift? Well, W is nothing other than any ontic state which has the correct outcomes for all the measurements in V. So it's just, we've got our big state space with many, many ontic states. We just need to find one of them which has all the properties consistent with our measurements, and that gives us our shift. It's a very nice interpretation. Okay, so I don't have too much longer, so I'll go over this fairly quickly, but you can ask me and you can particularly ask Lorenzo for details of this. So let me show you what these update rules look like. What they need to do, I mean, if you think about what's going on here, we have an epistemic restriction. So as we learn new things, we have to forget old things. And in particular, we have to forget the outcomes of measurements which are incompatible with the new measurements we've made. So it's a combination of randomization and the update of the states that we know. That means V has to change. to correspond with the new things that we know. And also W changes because the ontic state we'd chosen previously as our representative ontic state may not be compatible with the measurement outcomes of the measurements we've just made. So we need to find a new one. And so in this paper, you'll find rules for this. I'm not going to go through the details, but this is a very nice figure from our paper illustrating how it works. And you can see here are our shifted subspaces. We can also represent the measurement itself by a shifted subspace, and we can combine them in such a way that we know how to update our description under measurement. Okay. So all I want to say, I'm not going to go through the details of this, but all I want to say is to point out that this measurement update rule, at least the one we came up with, requires in it the computation of an inverse, a multiplicative inverse. Okay? In particular, what we have to do, we take the vector in phase space representing our observable, and we find the inner product of that vector with itself. That gives us a number k, and the inverse of k goes into our update rule. Now, this is where working with prime d is very nice, because in prime d, you're working with a number field, and there's always a multiplicative inverse for every number. So that's nice. That's not the case in non-prime D. So here's an example, Z4. You see there's no multiplicative inverse for 2, for example, because 2x equals 1 has no solution. So this rule cannot be applied in D equals 4. And so we had to resolve this problem, and resolving it sort of led to uncover what the issue is, the structural issue with the non-prime case, which is sort of which makes it objectively different to the prime case. It's we have a new type of observable, and this is very easy to see with a simple example. Let's think of Z4. Our measurements x and z by definition have four outcomes corresponding to the elements of Z4, 0, 1, 2, 3, 4. Now consider the variable 2x. Now we know from our rule tells us that to get the outcomes of this observable, we need to multiply all of the outputs of our original x observable by 2. And when we do this modulo 4, we get 0, 2, 0, 2. You see, we just get, so 2x is a degenerate measurement. So there's a whole new family of different types of Pauli observables. They're no longer all equal. Some of them have this degeneracy property. And we called them fine-grained and coarse-grained measurements, and we characterized them. So we worked out which are the measurements which are coarse-grained, which are the ones that are fine-grained. But they always have this property, that every coarse-grained observable can be built out of fine-grained observables. So here, we can build 2x by first measuring 1x and then multiplying by 2. Okay. So we can use that construction to build an update rule which works in all dimensions. And in particular, one of the nice properties of the mathematics that comes out, whenever you have a fine-grained measurement, it turns out that the measurement update rule we used before, this k element of Zd we had to invert, does have a unique inverse, and we can use the rule directly. So this is another beautiful picture from the paper illustrating the rule for the case of these coarse-grained measurements. And I will refer you to the paper for more details. So the final piece of the puzzle that we do in the paper is just to really show that actually the Spekens model and stabilizer quantum mechanics really do coincide. And of course the tool we use is the gross Wigner function. So this hasn't come out very well on the slide, but if you look in the paper, you'll see that we go through, look at measurement update rules, state description, etc., and show how the three coincide in each of the three theories. So we've got Wigner functions, Spekens theory, stabilizer quantum mechanics, all giving equivalent representations, all giving equivalent results. So that's the I'm coming to the end of the talk. So I've covered most of these key things. I'm ready to wrap up. Don't worry, Chair. But before I wrap up, there's one thing I wanted to talk about, which I think is quite interesting independently, and that's the n equals 1 case. So our theorem does not hold when we have a system of a single qudit. And you might ask, well, is that just because we didn't try hard enough? That's a fair enough thing to ask. Didn't Mark Howard et al. Prove this for the n equals 1 case in their paper? Well, no, they didn't. Their construction only works when you build witnesses that have two-qubit operators. So in our notation, their counterexample is an n equals 2 counterexample. And the same, and we can make the same reasoning that they did. We can consider the contextuality of single qubit states because we can tensor product them with a maximally mixed state, and we still have a contextual state. So that is the case, that is the way in which one qubit states are contextual in our theory and in their theory. But what about this n equals 1 case? Can we do anything? Well, we've got Speckens' model. Speckens' model is a concrete hidden variable model for the n equals 1 case. And Speckens' model does satisfy this character property that was the basis of all of our results. So certainly, one can find non-contextual value assignments to satisfy the property. But you know, we can't prove that this holds in general. We cannot construct these things. It's fairly straightforward to convince yourself that it's impossible to link together non-commuting observables in the single system case. And it turns out that the character lemma is simply false. We can construct simple non-contextual value assignments that do not satisfy the character lemma. The reason we can do that, essentially, is that we end up with completely disjoint sets of non-commuting observables, and the interrelation between the value assignments of these completely incompatible sets can be arbitrary because there'll be no experiment where you'd ever be able to relate them. Okay, so that means we don't need we don't have this character proof. And does that mean that Wigner negativity implies non-contextuality in n equals 1? No, we can provide counterexamples. We can construct models which are well represented in our non-contextual value assignment theory, but which have negative Wigner functions. So I don't know what the take-home message from that is. I think, well, possibly it's a warning that the n equals 1 case, particularly in stabilizer quantum mechanics, the n equals 1 case is anomalous, and studying it on its own may be misleading. But it actually is an opportunity. I mean, we could play around with these n equals 1 models, and maybe we'll find some interesting alternative representations, alternative paths. Or maybe there's nothing interesting there, but it's something we can explore. I mean, other things I'd like to develop is better understand what we can do with this kind of web of commuting observables, which allows us to connect together all of the Pauli observables. That feels like that might have some sort of application. We've used a very traditional notion of non-contextuality. I learned we used the notion in the 1967 paper. Can we link what we've done to Speckens' non-contextuality? Well, presumably we can, relatively straightforwardly, because via the Wigner function formalism, but we haven't done that yet. And you know, are there any applications of this? I mean, one thing that this result gives us, actually, is it gives us a very clean way of reasoning about stabilizer quantum mechanics in all odd dimensions. And the non-prime dimension stabilizer quantum mechanics has always been a bit thorny to work with. This gives us some new tools we can use to study that. So that might be useful, for example, in quantum error correction theory. Who knows? But what about qubits? I haven't mentioned anything about qubits. Well, fortunately, Juan is on the way after the break to tell you our work in this area about the n equals 2 case. So I won't tell you anything about that. I would just like to thank my collaborators and conclude and take questions.
Yes.
So we found a counterexample for d equals 3, so yes, it's prime, yes. Yeah, it doesn't, whether it's prime or not doesn't seem to play a role here.
Can you go back to that and explain again what the example was?
So let me.
You meant to say that the bigger negative implied contextuality.
Oh, probably, yes. Sorry. Yes, I do. Absence of a non-contextual. What I really strictly want to say means absence of a non-contextual value assignment, and that's not true. So all you do to make these counter examples is you just mess with the character property. So you just write down a character assignment. So I had at the beginning of my talk these value assignments that were all very nicely well behaved. They all looked like this. Okay. And so all I need to do is take this for U, take another one for V, right? Write it down. Then take another one for U plus V. And just make sure that this one is not equal to this plus this. Or this, the elements here are not equal to this times this. And then I've got a value assignment I can construct states for, and then you can just check that you can get negative bigner function states with those.
These will be non-contextual assignments.
No, these are contextual. So These have non-contextual value assignments. And they don't have a non-negative Wigner function. And just the reason is that the Wigner function has this character property built in, and these series don't. So they disagree, and that leads you to a different set of states.
I have a question. Yep. There's a point in your talk where you said the algebraic space has to be phase space. Uh-huh. I can't remember exactly what the context was, but I thought this might be relevant to connecting the Wigner function negativity to my notion, the failure of my notion of non-contextuality. So let me tell you what my intuition was, and maybe you can tell me what your result has to do with this. So we know that negativity, if you cannot find a quasi-probability representation of positive, then that corresponds to not being able to find a non-contextual quasi-model in my sense.
Mm-hmm.
But, the Wigner representation is just one.
Yes.
So, if you have negative Wigner representation, maybe you could find another quasi-probability representation that was positive, but it doesn't establish it. However, if you look at the transformations and you say they have to be represented in the topological model, then as soon as you have the whole Clifford group, you kind of are forcing your optic state space to have symplectic structure to be able to represent all those unitaries as bijective maps on your optic state space.
Yes.
So I think you're going to be forced to have your optic state space be the phase space
if
you want to represent the Clifford operation. And it seems to me that you have proven that, or that's what I want to know. Is that
I think you could probably extend our proof to prove that, yes. I don't think it seems to be.
That's excellent. So then I think you can indeed generalize your result to say now. Not negativity for all quasi-probability representations, but just negativity for Wigner representation. Well, I you're going to need the Clifford group.
Yes, I need to think about that, but that could well be a way of extending this. Yeah, that's a nice suggestion.
What exactly was it that you proved then?
So what we proved is that you get, so when you start off with this non-contextual value assignment definition, you always have this character property, and when you have this character property, you always have a non-negative Wigner function. But not only that, we did not assume the structure of the ontic space. And then we show that the ontic space, basically this thing, turns into a Kronecker delta, which just gives you an equivalence between elements of W and elements of the ontic space. So the phase points just have to be the ontic space for this equation to hold. Yes?
Did somebody else spoke for
Q-dits? So, yes. Everything I have spoken about only holds for Q-dits of odd dimension. And we know, I mean, this doesn't hold for qubits, for example. It holds in Speckan's model. I mean, the Perez-Mermin square is a counterexample to being able to do this. I mean, because another way of interpreting this rule is it's a complete absence of Perez-Mermin non-contextuality. Once you've fixed U and V, the value of U plus V is fixed regardless of whether U and V commute.
Thanks, Dan.
Thank you.